The right of freedom of speech and press includes not only the right to utter or to print, but the right to distribute, the right to receive, the right to read, and freedom of inquiry, freedom of thought, and freedom to teach. United States Supreme Court, Griswold v. Connecticut. Dr. Dudley Wycombe Finch knew that his people thought of this working office he had chosen, much too small for the director of the all-important English research establishment, too cluttered and too remote from the center of things here at Huddersfield. In the days when Huddersfield had been devoted to the physical sciences, this had been the basement office of a research assistant. The building above it stood on the perimeter of the fence-enclosed grounds. It was a three-story concrete structure with no ivy and little character. Wycombe Finch did maintain another office for state occasions back in the administration building. That was a spacious oaken suite with thick rugs and barriers of administrative assistance in the outer rooms, but this little cubicle and its adjoining lab were where he was to be found most of the time. Here, in an enclosure of windowless walls covered by bookshelves, its one door leading into the small laboratory. The desk was small enough that he could reach the farthest corner easily with either hand. The one chair was comfortable, high-backed and swiveled. And here he kept his radio and the listening devices and the electronic tools. He leaned back in the chair and puffed on his long, thin-stemmed pipe while waiting for the morning call from Doheny. He and Doheny had met on several occasions at international conferences, and Wycombe Finch could picture his Irish counterpart when they spoke on the telephone, a short, rather stout man with a blustery manner. Wycombe Finch was a contrasting tall, thin, gray-mantled figure. An American colleague, once seeing him with Doheny, had called them Mutt and Jeff, labels that Wycombe Finch had found offensive. A dottle of bitter nicotine burbled out of his pipe stem, burning his tongue. Wycombe Finch wiped away the offending particles with a white linen handkerchief, which he realized belatedly was one from the bottom of the drawer, one of those his wife Helen had laundered before. He veered his mind away from that channel. Outside the small office, he knew, the morning was a cold and misty grayness, all distances lost in the drifting diffusion. A lakes country morning, they called it locally. The telephone in front of him waited a scattering of papers, reports, summations. He stared at them while he smoked and waited. The telephone link between Ireland and England was none too satisfactory at best, and he had learned to be patient in dealing with these regular exchanges between himself and Doheny. The telephone buzzed. He put the instrument to his ear, laying aside the pipe in an ashtray. "Wycombe Finch here." Doheny's distinct tenor was identifiable despite a poor connection that provided static and distinct clicks. Lots of listeners, Wycombe Finch thought. "Ah, there you are, Wy. The damnable phone service is at its worst this morning." Wycombe Finch smiled. He had last met Doheny at a London conference on interdisciplinary cooperation. Jolly fellow, and with a first-class scientific mind behind those wide blue eyes. It was only during these regular telephone exchanges, though, that they had formed what Wycombe Finch thought of as a working friendship. Doe and Why. They had fallen into this first-name familiar relationship by the third call. "I'm convinced the telephone was created to teach us patience, Doe," Wycombe Finch said. "Stiff upper lip and all that, eh?" Doheny said. "Well, what's new, Why?" "We've a new government boffin coming down this morning for an assessment of our progress," Wycombe Finch said. "I know the chap, Rupert Stoner. No head for science, but very alert to wool over the eyes."
"Stoner," Doheny said. "I've heard of him. Political."
"Oh, very."
"What do you have to tell him?"
"Bloody nothing. Plodding, that's what we're doing. Good plodding, the kind that'll produce in time, but no big breakthrough, which is what Stoner and his people want.
What about those four new people you've added? The American, Beckett. I hear he's the one figured out how the madman spread this thing.
Brilliant fellow, no doubt of it. I've kept the four of them together as a team. There's something about the way they work together. I hesitate to call it electric, but they are one of those happy associations that often produce great things.
Tell that to Stoner.
He already knows it. I was hoping you might produce a little tidbit we could share with him, Doe. After a moment's silence, Doheny said,
"We don't hide very much from you, do we, Wire?"
Wycombe Finch recognized this approach, part of a subtle code he and Doheny had worked out between the lines. Doheny had something to reveal, something hot that his masters might resent his telling. But that wouldn't matter now, because Wycombe Finch obviously already knew it.
"I hope you don't even try," Wycombe Finch said, picking up on his side.
"God knows I resent the use of spies, and I assure you, Doe, that we are being completely candid with you." Doheny's laughter rattled in the phone. Wycombe Finch smiled gently. What in the devil had Doheny come up with?
"Well," Doheny said, "it's true. We may have O'Neill himself."
Wycombe Finch took advantage of a long burst of static to ask sharply,
"What?"
"I didn't hear that."
"The madman. We may have him here."
"You have the fellow in durance? Interrogators and all that?"
"God in heaven, no.
I'm sending him the long way to our facility at Killaloe. He's using the name John Garrick O'Donnell. Claims to be a molecular biologist."
"How sure are you?"
Wycombe Finch could feel his heart beating rapidly. No telling who might be listening to this conversation.
Very dangerous.
Doheny had to answer that question correctly.
"We're not positive, why? But I tell you, he tickles my neck hairs.
We've one of our best men clinging to him like a leech, a priest ready at hand should he wish to confess, and a poor bereaved young boy in the party so he can see constantly what he's done."
Wycombe Finch shook his head slowly from side to side.
"Doe, you are a bloody awful man. You set this up."
"I took advantage of a situation that was handed to us."
"You are still bloody clever, Doe." "Conscience, that'll be the key to the fellow. That is, if we are to believe that profile the Americans produced."
"My God, this does take a little thinking."
"I confess I doubted it when our cloak and dagger boys told me."
"We're not getting our hopes up too high. But it is something to tell your man Stoner.
He probably already knows. I suggest you be very careful, though. O'Neill may have some new nastiness up his sleeve. That is, if it's the madman.
Kid gloves. That's the way we're doing it."
"Terribly muddy waters, though." This referred to a joke they had exchanged at a conference, muddy waters being the most fertile for new growth. Doheny picked up on it immediately.
"Very roiled indeed. I'll let you know if they get muddier."
"Quite. Are the Americans helping?"
"We haven't said anything to them for the obvious reasons why. Earlier they did send us some material, just in case, but it's very scanty. No fingerprints, no dental records. They blame the panic fire, which may be the actual case."
"And if this O'Donnell, you say, if he is just what he says he is?"
"We're going to give him the mental thumbscrews. A triple approach,
all adding up to one thing. He must come up with a brilliant new approach to our researches."
"Triple approach?
Oh, you mean in case he's actually O'Neill and you're unable to prove it?"
"Damned right. He could give us a real clue, or try artful concealment or a diversion.
Or actual sabotage. As good as a confession, that.
A burst of static, painfully loud, intruded on the line. When it passed, Doheny could be heard saying, "Beckett's group is doing?" Wycombe Finch took it as a question. "I think the fellow to watch there is the little frog Hup. Got a devious mind. He feeds things to Beckett almost as though he were playing Beckett, using the man as a personal computer.
Blimey,
as you Brits say." "We say nothing of the kind, you Irish potato-eater." Both chuckled. It was a weak enough chiggering, Wycombe Finch thought, not enough to fool the listeners, but it had become almost ritual between them now, signalling that they were near the end of the conversation.
"If we ever meet face to face again, I'll whip your ears with my shillelagh, if I can find one of the blasted things," Doheny said.
A tear slid down Wycombe Finch's left cheek. The stereotypes had been laid out to be chuckled at, but could they be discarded? Perhaps they played this game to keep the mistakes of the past fresh in their minds. Brawley against Shillelagh, the ridiculous against the ridiculous. A sigh shook Wycombe Finch, and he thought he heard its echo from Doheny. "I'll fill Stoner with visions of sugar-plum fairies from Ireland," Wycombe Finch said. "But your man O'Donnell is probably just what he says." "A molecular biologist is a molecular biologist," Doheny said. "We'd use Jesus, Mary, and Joseph themselves if they showed up." "Didn't O'Donnell carry any identification?" Wycombe Finch asked, speaking as the thought hit him. "A thickhead in command of the party that met him threw away the man's passport."
"Threw it away?"
"Over his shoulder into the sea. No chance to scrutinize it now and determine if it was a forgery."
"Doe,
I think sometimes we are the victims of a deliberately malign fate."
"Let's pray there is a balancing, benevolent fate.
Perhaps it's Beckett's team. By the way, Doe, Beckett and his people think the zipper theory may be confusing us, leading us down the garden path, so to speak."
"Interesting. I'll pass it along."
"Sorry, I've nothing more substantial for you."
"Why, a thought just occurs to me. Why don't you put Stoner together with Beckett?
Brilliant Yank explaining the intricacies of marvelous scientific research to uninformed politician.
Might be interesting," Wycombe Finch agreed.
"It could even spark some new ideas in Beckett," Doheny said. "Explaining things to the uninitiated sometimes does that.
I'll give it a think.
Beckett, when he gets going, can be quite fluent."
"I'd like to talk to Beckett myself. Could he join us for one of these confabs?"
"I'll arrange it." "Hup, too?"
"No, just Beckett.
Perhaps Hup later. And please, prime Beckett for heavy interrogation, would you, why?" "As I say, he is quite fluent, Doe." There was silence filled with static for a moment. Then Wycombe Finch said, "I'll put together a report on their ideas about the zipper theory. We'll fax it to you first thing. Might be something in it, although I'm not giving ground."
"Beckett needs resistance, eh?"
"It primes him well. Keep that in mind when you talk."
"Does he get angry?"
"Never shows it, but it's there."
"Fine, fine. I'll be at my Yankee baiting best. And as far as this possible madman is concerned, I'll let you know if the waters get muddier."
Wycombe Finch nodded to himself. Totally muddy, of course, would mean they had confirmed the man as O'Neill. He said, "There is one thing more, Doe. Stoner may be coming here to dismiss me.
Tell him to cut the phone lines to us if he does."
"Now, Doe, don't burn any bridges."
"I mean it. We Irish don't take naturally to you Brits. I'll not waste my time breaking in another contact at Huddersfield. You tell him."
It only took us a week to get on a solid footing.
Nowadays, a week is forever.
The politicians haven't figured that out yet. They need us. We don't need them.
Oh, I think we do, Doe. We stand together, why, or the whole bloody edifice comes crashing down. You tell that stoner I said so.
Until next time, then.
As you say, Doe. Wycombe Finch heard the click of the connection being broken. The static stopped. He replaced his telephone in its cradle and stared at his cold pipe beside it. Well, the listeners had been told. Doheny was right in his own way, of course. Scientists had created this awful mess. Contributed to it, anyway, and no denying that. Bad communication, bad liaison with governments, failure to exercise what power we had, or even to recognize the real nature of power. When we did move, we played the same old political games. He glanced up at the wall of books on his left without really seeing them. What if it was Madman O'Neill over there in Ireland? Should there prove to be a way of using him, Doheny was sly enough to find it. But God help us all if the wrong people learned about it on the outside. Wycombe Finch shook his head. Good thing the man was in Doheny's hands. He picked up his pipe and relighted it, thinking about this. Not until this moment had he realized how much faith he had developed in Doheny's crafty ways. If there is one principle clearer than any other, it is this, that in any business, whether of government or mere merchandising, somebody must be trusted. Woodrow Wilson. All this time with the damn Yank and not a clue, Herity thought. It was mid-afternoon, and they were plodding upward out of another shallow valley, the boy and the priest walking a bit ahead. The boy had been even more withdrawn since the fight in the bathhouse, his silence a deeper thing. Father Michael was accusatory. It was all Herity's fault. It's all that damn Yank's fault. And the priest isn't helping. A Yank did it to us. Made a ghetto of Ireland. Herity had never thought of himself as a super-patriot. Only a typical Irishman, bitter over the centuries of British oppression. He felt a tribal loyalty to his people and the land, a kinship of the wrath. There was a pulling force in the Irish earth, he thought. It was a memory that lived in the soil itself. It remembered, and always had. Even if there were no more people, there would be something here, an essence that would tell how the Gaels had passed this way once. Father Michael was talking to the Yank, not probing, not doing what he should to see if it was a mask the man wore and the madman himself underneath. Black thoughts in his mind, Herity listened. "There are more ruins now," Father Michael said. "You noticed that?"
"Destruction, it seems," John said.
"But plenty of food. More that's fallen down. We've lost the look of the picaresque that really great ruins sometimes have. Now, it's just tumble down." They fell silent, passing another burned cottage whose walls butted up against the road. The blank windows exposed ashed tatters of curtains like wounded eyelids. "Someone will answer for that," Herity thought. He felt the long Irish memory barbed like a spear. Offend it, and some day you would feel the thrust and see your life welling from the wound. They crested the top of the hill then and paused for breath, looking ahead to the long curve of another valley stretched out into mists at the upper end where a stream cascaded off black rocks, making its mark on the air with a moist screen that hid the farther hills. A hen cackled nearby. Herity cocked an ear, hearing the gurgle of water, a brook or a spring.
"I hear water," John said.
"We could do with a bit of rest and some food," Father Michael said. He crossed to the lower side of the road where tall grass covered a long slope into trees. Finding a spot in the stone wall where he could swing himself across, he went a few paces out into the tall grass. The boy leaped the wall and joined the priest. John looked up at the sky. Clouds were coming in, filling the western horizon. He glanced at Herity, who waved for him to join the priest and boy. John climbed onto the wall and stood there looking across the open land before jumping down. The landscape had been defined by gray rock walls into green rectangles with a few cottages, all black and roofless, sprinkled among them. He heard Herity cross the wall and come up beside him.
"There's a beauty to it yet," Herity said.
John glanced at him, then returned his attention to the view. The thin mist reduced the middle distances to muted pastels, a rolling meadowland with a river winding through it, tall trees and darker greens on the far side.
"Are you thirsty, Mr. O'Donnell?" Herity asked.
But he looked at O'Neill as he spoke.
"I could do with a cool drink of spring water," John agreed.
"I'm thinking you have no knowledge of thirst," Herity said. "A cool glass of Guinness with foam as white as a virgin's panties flowing over the edges. Now there's a vision to raise a man's thirst."
Father Michael and the boy began walking toward the trees below the meadow.
"I heard you and the priest talking about the ruins," Herity said.
"It's not ruins. Decay. That's the word. Hope destroyed, finally."
The priest and the boy stopped short of the trees near a granite outcropping. Looking after them, Herity said,
"A fine man, the priest."
"Wouldn't you agree, Mr. O'Donnell?"
At the jibing question, John felt O'Neill within begin to rise. Panic threatened him, then rage. "Others have suffered as much as you, Herity. You're not alone." A flush of blood darkened Herity's face. His lips tightened into a thin line, and his right hand went toward the pistol under his jacket, but hesitated, and lifted instead to scratch the beard stubble on his chin.
"Would you listen to us now?" he asked. "We're like a couple of wains in—"
He broke off, stopped by the loud report of a shot from down in the trees below them. In one motion, Herity knocked John off his feet into the grass, rolled away with one hand in his pack, and before he stopped rolling had a small machine gun in his hands and was scrambling down to the shelter of the granite outcropping. He stopped there, peering down into the trees. John was right behind him, leaning up against the cold stone. John peered around his edge of the rock, looking for the priest and the boy. Were they hurt? Who had shot, and where had it been aimed? A limb cracked below him, and Father Michael's pale and hatless head poked out of covering bushes under the trees. He was a wide-eyed blob of white against the green and brown background, the scar on his forehead very plain against the pale skin. He was staring directly up at John.
"Get your face back in here," Herity said.
He yanked John back into the rock's cover. "I saw Father Michael. He seems to be all right."
"And the boy?"
"I didn't see him."
"We'll be patient a bit," Herity said. "That was a rifle shot."
He cradled the machine gun against his chest and leaned back, scanning the rock wall bordering the road above them. John looked at the weapon in Herity's hands. Seeing John's attention, Herity said,
"The Jews make fine guns now, don't they?"
He whirled at the sound of swishing grass below them. John looked up to see Father Michael peering down at them. The black felt hat once more covered the brand-scarred forehead. Herity scrambled to his feet and peered past the priest toward the trees.
"Where's the boy?"
"Safe behind some more boulders down there in the trees."
"Only the one rifle shot?" Herity said.
"Likely someone shooting a cow or a pig."
"Or himself. That being the more common thing nowadays."
"You're a man full of evil,"
Father Michael said. He pointed at the machine gun.
"Where did you get that terrible weapon?"
"This fine Uzi, made by the clever Jews. I took it off a dead man, Father Michael."
"Isn't that where we get most things nowadays?"
"What do you intend with it?" Father Michael asked.
"To use it if need be."
"Exactly where did you leave the boy?"
Father Michael turned and pointed at the gray gleam of more rocks just within the trees, the granite partly hidden by invading gorse.
"We will go down there one at a time," Harity said. "I will go first, Mr. O'Donnell, next, then you, priest. Stay here until I call."
Crouching low, Harity darted from behind the rocks and ran zigzagging down the slope into the trees. They saw him duck behind the other rocks. Then his voice called,
"Just the way I did it."
John darted from behind the boulder, feeling exposed and vulnerable as he ran down the slope. Left, right, left, and into a pocket between the rocks where he saw the boy crouched, huddled into the blue coat. There was no sign of Harity. The boy stared at John with a blank expression. There came the sound of running, and Father Michael joined them, putting a protective arm around the boy. Harity reappeared then, trotting up from deeper in the trees. He joined them in the rock shelter, breathing heavily, the machine gun held at the ready across his chest.
"The three of you will stay here until I've looked over the land below us," Harity said. "That was a foolish thing you did, priest, sauntering up there through the open after such a shot."
"If God means me to go now, he will take me now," Father Michael said.
"Or so you hoped," Harity said. "It's a sin, Father. Remember that. When you court death, how is that different from deliberate suicide?"
Father Michael cringed. Harity started to leave, but John detained him with a hand on his arm.
"Joseph."
Harity turned a surprised look at John.
"I'm grateful for your concern," John said, "and I'd like you to call me John, but I'll not change one word of what I said up there."
He gestured with his chin up the hill toward where Harity had knocked him down to protect him.
"I meant every word of it."
Harity grinned.
"Of course you did, Yank."
With that, Harity ducked from behind the sheltering rocks and ran down into the trees. They heard a limb crack, then silence.
"A strange man, that," Father Michael said.
The boy pulled away from the priest and peered over the sheltering rocks.
"Here, stay down," Father Michael said.
He pulled the boy back.
"Harity acts like a soldier," John said. "Thought he does.
Where did you encounter him?" Father Michael looked away, hiding his face from John, but not before John saw a look of near panic there. What was it between those two? The priest and the violent man of action. Father Michael spoke in a choked voice.
"You might say God threw Joseph and me together. The reason for it, I cannot say."
He returned his gaze to John, the features composed.
"What about the boy?" John asked.
"Why is he with you?"
"A band of tinkers gave him to me," Father Michael said. "You'd call them gypsies. But they're not really, you know. They treated him well. They were the ones told me of his vow of silence."
"Then he can talk?"
"I've heard him cry out in his sleep."
The boy closed his eyes and bowed his head into the blue jacket.
"Has he a name?"
John asked.
"Only he can say. And he won't."
"Have you made any attempt to find his—"
"Hush now."
Father Michael glared at John.
"Some pains are best not poked at, man."
John turned his head away abruptly, trying to control a rictus grin. There was a pain in his breast. He could feel O'Neill within moving closer and closer to the surface. John put both hands over his face, trying to quell the dangerous other. A sound of tumbling pebbles brought his face jerking up out of his hands.
Harity ducked into their shelter. Perspiration ran down his face. Burrs and catch seeds tangled the lower part of his green trousers. The Israeli machine gun was still cradled against his breast.
He took a moment to catch his breath, then,
"There's two cottages just over the next ridge, and smoke from the both of them. There's a radio, and them listening to the news, talking about it."
Father Michael cleared his throat.
Any sign of—"
"Nary a sign of a female," Harity said. "Only men's clothing on the wash line. Neat, though. Both cottages neat and well tended. I'm thinking it's only men who've been well trained by their womenfolk."
"Graves?"
Father Michael asked.
four of them in the meadow, below the cottages. "Then perhaps the people there would shelter us," Father Michael said.
"Not so quick," Herity said. He looked at John.
"Do you think you could use this weapon, John?"
John looked at the machine gun, sensing the power in it. He flexed his fingers.
"Use it for what?" "I've a mind to walk up to those cottages open and friendly-like," Herity said. "With yourself covering me from above. There's rocks and a fine vantage on the ridge."
John glanced at the priest.
"I'll not bless this," Father Michael said. "The church has sinned enough, calling on God to bless murder."
"We've no mind to murder anyone," Herity said.
"You're going soldiering," Father Michael said.
"All that," Herity said.
"I'm just not ready to commit suicide, Father."
He looked at John.
"What about it, John?"
John held out his hands for the machine gun. "Show me how it works."
"Very simple," Herity said.
He stepped up beside John with the gun.
"This here's the safety. When it's like this,"
he clicked it.
"All you need to do is point it and pull the trigger. Steady as the rock of Cashel it is."
Herity restored the gun to safety and passed it to John. John hefted the weapon. It felt warm from Herity's touch, a thing much more direct than the plague. Would O'Neill within rise up now and kill with noisy violence? John looked up to see Herity studying him.
"Can you do it?"
Herity asked. John nodded.
"Then follow me. Silent as a mouse in a feather bed.
Priest, you and the boy stay where you are until we call."
"God willing," Father Michael said.
"There now," Herity pounced, grinning. "He's blessed us after all."
Herity led the way, then at a bent-over trot, they went down into the trees, following a scuffed track in the needle duff, crossing over a thin runnel of water splashing across black rocks.
John stopped, thirsty, looking first at the water and then at Herity.
"I'd not drink it," Herity whispered. "There's a dead man upwind."
He pointed up the stream's course.
"Dead a week at least, and foul in the water."
Herity smiled.
"Pigs has been at him."
John shuddered. Herity turned away. John followed him up the opposite slope, moving slowly through scrub conifers. The duff underfoot muffled their steps. At the ridge top, Herity motioned John to stay low, then pointed along the ridge to the left where a gray rock buttress could be glimpsed through the brown trunks.
"From up there," Herity whispered, "you've a grand view down into their dooryard. I'll wait until I see you in place, then go along whistling, friendly and open, without a weapon in sight. You understand?"
John nodded. He bent low and scrambled upward through the trees, approaching the rocks from below the ridgetop. Creeping over the top, he found he could slide out onto the rocks. They smelled flinty and were still warm from the earlier sunlight. He glanced upward. It would be dark soon, and the clouds had rain in them. Slowly he crept out onto a shallow cup within the rocks until his eyes could peer over the end. He found himself looking down a steep slope no more than 100 meters into a fenced yard behind a neat cottage. Whitewashed walls there, two chimneys and smoke from both of them. Chickens scratching in the yard. The roof of another cottage poked up against the valley backdrop beyond the first one, smoke from only one of its chimneys. A cow byre had been built into the hillside off to the left. There was a smell of cow manure from it. The valley beyond contained a scattering of burned-out cottages and wrecked outbuildings, not a sign of smoke there. He returned his attention to the near cottage. A clothesline had been strung from a corner of the building to a post in the stone-enclosed yard. Clothing waved in the wind there. Trousers, shirts, long underwear. There was the faint sound of a radio, someone talking. Everything looked so bucolic, except for the stillness and something lacking behind the sound of the radio and the clucking of the chickens. Abruptly, John froze at the sound of voices almost directly below him under the rock outcropping where he could not see.
"They'll not see us in here."
It was the voice of a young boy.
"How much in the bottle?"
Another young voice.
"Almost a cup."
That was the first one.
"Do you really think this caused it?"
There was the sound of something scraping, a gurgling followed by a fit of coughing.
"Ugh! That's awful! She said it was the drink, Berg. And now she's gone."
"It's all stupid grown-up stuff." Something brushed against the rocks below John. He held his breath.
"Grown-ups never know what they want."
There came a long silence below John in which he thought he could hear his own heart beating too loudly. He dared not move. He might scrape against the rock, alerting the boys, and they could call a warning to the people in the cottages. He moved only his eyes, trying to glimpse Herity, wondering where the man might be.
"I'm glad you and your Da came to live in the other cottage, Berg."
That was the first child.
"It was bad in the city." "Lots of shooting?"
"Yes."
"Here, too. We hid in a cave."
Again, they were silent. Why was Herity delaying, John wondered. His chest felt painful when he breathed.
"Do you remember what happened to your Ma?"
That was the first child.
"Yes." "I miss mine. Sometimes I think I'd best go to heaven and be with her. My Da's no fun anymore."
"Mine drinks this stuff."
"I know.
What's the drink do to you?"
"I think it's going to make me sick."
"Nah, you didn't have enough of it."
"Hist!"
There was silence beneath John's hiding place. He heard it then. Herity singing of his dark Rosaline, a fine tenor voice approaching the cottages from below.
"Someone coming!"
That was the first child, a hoarse whisper.
"A stranger! I see him!"
A man's voice called from the near cottage.
"Berg! Terry!"
"Should we answer?"
That was the second child.
"No! Stay here! If it's trouble, we'll be safer in here."
"The stranger's alone."
Herity called out loudly from below.
"Hello, the cottages? Anybody home?"
A man's voice responded. "Who is it asking?"
"It's Joseph Herity of Dublin Town. I've a priest and a young boy with me, and a Yank who fancies himself the saviour of Ireland. Would you be giving food and shelter to weary travellers?"
The man in the house shouted, "Step up close, and let's have a look at you." Herity strode to within a few meters of the near cottage's rear door. He raised his arms and turned to show he was unarmed. John saw movement of a gun barrel behind an open window of the cottage, but no shot came.
"You've a priest with you, did you say?"
the man in the house asked.
"I did that. It's Father Michael Flannery of Maynooth, himself as fine a priest as ever wore the black. And I see a cross over your door that tells me you're not priest-haters in this house."
"We've graves that need blessing,"
the man in the house said, his voice lower.
"Sure, and Father Michael would be happy to do that,"
Herity said.
"Shall I be calling him to join us?"
"Yes. And welcome."
Herity turned and cupped his hands to his mouth.
"Father Michael, you can all come in now. Pass the word to the Yank."
John started to rise, but at the last words hesitated. Something wrong down there? Herity would know John could hear him. A wide smile on his face, Herity strode up to the cottage door as it was opened from inside. He thrust out a hand.
"It's Joseph Herity would like the name of you, sir."
"Terence Gannon," said the man in the house. A thick hand was extended toward Herity. Herity took the hand and jerked Gannon out of the house, deflecting a shotgun's muzzle while he spilled the man and removed the weapon from him. Gannon lay sprawled in the yard, Herity's pistol at his head.
"All right in there,"
Herity called through the open door.
"One move out of you and I blow the head off poor Terry Gannon here. My Yank friend is up there on the ridge with a machine gun if you've a mind to make the sacrifice." A thin, older man with grey hair and a pinched face, wearing green suspenders over underwear tops to hold up his brown woolen trousers, came out of the cottage with his hands over his head.
"Well, now," Harity said, "the two of you will be lying here on your faces, if you please."
He picked up the shotgun and threw it over the wall of the yard. When both men were stretched out on the ground in front of the door, Harity lifted his head toward John's vantage place.
"You heard him call, Yank? There's more of 'em here." "Only two little boys," Gannon said, his voice muffled against the ground.
"They're in the rock right below me," John shouted, "and that's where they'll stay."
"That's grand," Harity called.
Turning with his pistol at the ready, Harity entered the house. He emerged presently and strode around the side toward the other cottage. There was the sound of a door being slammed open, and, in a moment, Harity reappeared, herding a teenage boy whose round face was a pale mask of terror framed in loose black hair.
"That's the lot of 'em," Harity called. "This one was in there playing with hisself. For shame!"
Harity laughed loudly. John stood, seeing Father Michael and the boy emerge from the trees along a narrow farm track off to the right. Father Michael waved a cheery hand, then stopped as he saw Harity recovering the shotgun from the ground, the two men still stretched out near the door.
"Now what have you done, Joseph Harity?"
Father Michael demanded.
"I've just made certain sure we were not walking into the hornet's nest, Father."
He glanced at the two men on the ground.
"You and your friend can be standing now, Mr. Gannon, and I pray you'll forgive me cautious ways."
Gannon climbed to his feet and dusted himself off before helping the other man to stand. Gannon was a heavy-set man with long black hair. He had a broad chin and wide, thick-lipped mouth. His eyes, when he looked up at John, appeared withdrawn into hopeless defeat. John peered over the edge of the rock into the declivity beneath him.
"You boys down there, come out. No one's going to hurt you."
That was true, John thought. O'Neill within had withdrawn to some silent place, content to watch and enjoy the fruit of his revenge. Two tow-headed boys, one about 10 and the other slightly younger, emerged from beneath John and peered up at him. "Which of you is Berg?" John asked. The younger one raised a hand.
"Well, Berg," John said, "if there's any more in that bottle, I'd be grateful if you'd bring it down to the cottage."
Human societies have seldom been accustomed to long-range planning, reluctant to think of the generations. The unborn, the unconceived, do not vote on current affairs. We conform our researches to immediate conviction, our projects to immediate desires. Where is the voice of the yet-to-be? Without a voice, they will never be.
Finton Craig Doheny. It was half past lunch and too long to dinner. Stephen Browder prowled the steel-walled quarters that confined him with Kate, aware of her sitting in the corner there reading, aware that she knew of his restlessness. There was a visible mounding of her abdomen, evidence of the child forming there, and Peard had yet to produce a priest. Browder knew what had happened at Maynooth, but surely there must be a trustworthy priest available in all of Ireland. A real priest? There were enough fakes around, he knew, that Peard and his people had to be cautious. But somewhere there must be a priest to marry the two plague prisoners. He stopped at the tiny table where he had laid out some of his books and a stack of reports on the progress of plague research. Should he begin clearing away this mess in preparation for the table's use at dinner? No. Too early. Peard and his associates, thinking it would relieve tensions in the isolation chamber, had sent in a small fax machine. It produced regular copies on what the various research centers were reporting. From these reports, Browder achieved a fragmented picture of work all over the world.
He could picture countless white-coated figures carefully distributing loops of culture, the incubation chambers meticulously adjusted to 37 degrees centigrade, the impatient waiting through the mandatory 2 days of incubation for each test.
"And I'm confined here. No facilities. Only these damned books and these stupid, frustrating reports. What can I do to help?"
Was Pierre deliberately withholding a priest, as Kate accused? Idly, Browder picked up the top report on his table, a double-folded sheet off the fax printer. It was a copy of recent material from Huddersfield.
And what use was it?
So some people over there in England thought the zipper theory was faulty. He let his mind play with the theory, knowing that the Japanese were convinced of it. Two strands of the helix chained together by chemical bonds, replicating each other like the closing of a zipper.
What was wrong with that idea?
The Russians liked it. Doheny himself said it was a useful concept. Why would some people at Huddersfield begin to doubt it? He let the fax sheet drop back to the table. The plague intervenes in the body's enzyme systems. That was one fact emerging clearly all over the world. Very little ammonia in the bacterial cultures. The amino acids were being used for both structure and energy. But the energy was being bound up in structures that inhibited enzyme systems. Without enzymes, death intervened. But which systems? Structural function was being virtually stopped somewhere, inhibited. Agglutinins were not forming in the presence of antibiotics. The structure. They had to know the structure. The plague inhibited the oxygen-carbon dioxide cycle. By simple deduction, they knew that the DNA pattern for women had to be somewhere distinctly different from that for men. The deaths and severe illnesses of hermaphroditic individuals only confirmed this fact. Was the clue in the hormone systems, as the Canadians asserted? There had to be an interlocking virus-to-bacteria line of transmission in the plague. Had to be. Then what was the shape of the bacteriophage vector? Here was a pathogen that had been shaped to resist antibiotics. And the Americans were convinced that O'Neill had created a form of free DNA that searched for a place in the helix and locked itself there. Grows rapidly in culture medium, the Americans said. If they actually were looking at the plague pathogen, the rapid growth in itself was alarming. Other man-made recombinants did not do this. The shape. The structure. What was it? He thought about the double molecule, one chain twisted around the other in helical form, one chain fitted to the other in an elegant fashion, the adenine, guanine, cystosine, and thymine, each determining a link on the opposite chain. It was like an elegant maypole, Browder thought. A maypole without the central pole, the ribbons held together by their interlocking placement in the... Browder froze, seeing this shape in his mind.
"Is something wrong, dear?" Kate asked.
He looked at her wild-eyed.
"They're right," he said. "It's not a zipper."
He could visualize the helix itself winding upon itself, ribbon upon ribbon, a chain of chains locked into shape by the way it twisted. Browder began scrambling in the papers on his table, looking for a particular page. He found it and spread it flat, studying it. The thing is like a spiral staircase with only 4 structural parts. Those were the words of someone at Huddersfield named Hupp, a man obviously trying to simplify the picture of the DNA helix, allowing him an entry point in visualizing what O'Neill had done. The RNA transmitter and the DNA result may have another relationship. Could this be what the madman means when he refers to superimposition? One set off against the other could reveal that relationship. Browder looked up, thinking, aware that Kate was watching him with worry on her face.
"Maypole," he thought. "A twisted, convoluted maypole." explicitly coded instructions with only 4 letters in the code, but the 4 together in any combination represented another codon series. And then another, another. The maypole. The combinations. Kate put her book aside and stood up.
Stephen, what's wrong?
Oh, I must talk to the people at Huddersfield, he said. Where's Adrian?
He's gone to Dublin again. Don't you remember?
Oh, yes. Well, could they patch me through with our telephone? Who's outside there?
Only Moon, I think.
There's influenza going around, and they're short-handed.
Moon could do it. He's clever with electronics. Have you heard how he bugged the Paras HQ?
Browder strode to the phone on its stand beside the little wall desk.
Moon. Hey, out there. I've got a job for you, Moon. And you, the only man in all of Ireland who could do it.